Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You've probably heard this old saw before. Repeated enough times, it just might come true. After all, it worked for Dorothy. Perhaps it's time to fit the banking industry with some sparkly red shoes. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business. The brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Friday, the 18th day of April. All week long, investors heard from a parade of banking executives declaring, hey, you know all those massive losses we're reporting? No worries, mate. The worst, we think, is behind us. And investors bought it, quite literally, every time. Today, all the country's biggest bank had to say was that it's working to climb out of the hole. $14 billion in first quarter losses, good enough to bump Citigroup's stock up more than 4%. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, will try to explain.
Yeah, right. Trying to explain Wall Street's reaction this week is like, well, like trying to explain the rally that followed the first round of big losses the banks reported at the end of the last quarter. At Fifth Third Asset Management, portfolio manager John Fisher says the rationale then went something like this. Surely these banks have thrown in everything but the kitchen sink to get this over with.
Everyone thought that 3 months ago, and quickly thereafter, Citi and others were desperately raising capital, and we're talking about credit and the market's getting worse. So everyone was wrong 3 months ago with that assessment. I don't know why it's any more believable today.
Fisher says investors seem to be ignoring what even Citigroup executives were warning today about their credit card business. History has shown that economic slumps, especially if there's high unemployment, inevitably bring a surge of people unable to pay their bills.
Consumer credit has just now really started to deteriorate, so we're early on in that deterioration. So all of their credit businesses, their traditional basic bank businesses, you know, taking deposits and making loans, I mean, that credit stuff's going to get a lot worse.
Citigroup's finance chief, Gary Crittenden, conceded as much to analysts during a conference call today.
There's no assurance that the amount of marks that we've taken in this quarter are finished. I think we have substantially reduced our amount of risk, but there's always the prospect that you could have additional marks, and that throws the calculation of, you know, of that number pretty much out the window.
Wall Street may not have been listening, but those worries weren't lost on Fitch Ratings. It downgraded Citigroup's credit rating today. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
We tend to use things like consumer confidence, GDP, and inflation to measure how the economy's doing. Here's another indicator. Mexican immigrants are sending smaller and smaller portions of their paychecks home. Remittances dropped by nearly 7% in January compared to a year earlier. Because of tumbling wages and jobs here, many are returning home. But they're finding the economic picture in Mexico isn't much healthier. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
The parts of Mexico that are most dependent on cash from the U.S. are the areas seeing the steepest declines in remittances. That will certainly lead to greater poverty. And it could also mean more Mexicans will head north, says Kathleen Newland with the Migration Policy Institute.
Ironically, as people are getting less money from relatives in the United States, probably more people are going to set out for the United States, even knowing that it's become more difficult to find jobs.
Other experts disagree. They say most Mexicans migrate to the U.S. for one simple reason, to find a well-paying job. George Grayson is with the College of William and Mary.
Mexican poor people are extremely astute, and they're not going to waste their money trying to get into the United States when they realize that there is much less of a chance of finding a job now than there was, say, a year or two.
Grayson says these poor people will just have to make do in Mexico, the way they always have.
They are masters at stretching a limited amount of food, handing down clothing, and putting a blanket on the floor so that a family member who's out of work has a place to stay.
Experts say they don't have the data yet to gauge which way the migration wave is moving. Again, Kathleen Newland.
It's hard to say exactly at what point on this roulette wheel that ball is going to stop.
I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
If you've never heard of bisphenol A, get ready to hear a lot more. Walmart says it's going to stop selling baby bottles made with BPA. The company that makes the popular Nalgene water bottles announced it'll stop using BPA as well. And this afternoon, the Canadian government said it plans to ban the sale of BPA baby bottles. Sarah Gardner has more from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
Walmart has already stopped selling the bottles in its Canadian stores. The retailer expects to do the same in the U.S. by early next year. The decision comes amid a Canadian campaign to ban these bottles. A study released Monday by the U.S. National Toxicology Program also didn't hurt. That report raised concerns that BPA could cause behavioral changes in children and early puberty in girls. Mike Shade at the Center for Health, Environment and Justice applauded Walmart's decision.
This is terrific news. We're really delighted that Walmart is doing really the only sensible thing.
This shift away from BPA has been a boon to bottle manufacturers who use glass or alternative plastics. Those include niche players like Florida-based Born Free. The young company specializes in BPA-free plastic baby bottles. President Ron Vigder says the company's grown 100-fold since last year.
We are manufacturing as fast as we can right now in Israel to keep up with demand, and we're flying in products day in and day out.
Environmentalists like Mike Shade believe Walmart's decision to ban BPA bottles will trickle down to other retailers and manufacturers.
Their economic influence is unparalleled, so we're hopeful that this will have a major impact.
But the American Chemistry Council says recent reports about BPA are, quote, unnecessarily frightening the public. It says BPA is safe, according to the Food and Drug Administration, and it's asked the FDA to weigh in again. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Wall Street ended the week with a 500-point gain. Details when we talk to that guy down in Dallas. Today, Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe blamed the country's former colonial ruler, Britain, for its economic woes. It was Mugabe's first major speech since the still unresolved elections last month. He claimed that his political opposition would like to see the country, quote, go back to white people. The opposition and independent economists blame Mugabe's policies for the collapse of what was once Southern Africa's breadbasket. As Gretchen Wilson reports, the political impasse is delaying recovery and prolonging Zimbabwe's economic pain.
The country is staggering under this political uncertainty. Zimbabwe's economy is deteriorating rapidly. Inflation now tops 165,000%. Many people now eat only one meal a day. Independent election monitors have said opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai won the March election, but Mugabe has refused to step aside. Tsvangirai told Marketplace that the key to resurrecting Zimbabwe is reviving its economy. But before that happens, it needs to establish the rule of law.
The economy can be compared to a post-war situation. And in a post-war situation, there's one thing that you need to do. You need to respect the rule of law. You need to respect property rights.
Mugabe has effectively suspended these rights in the past by fixing prices, seizing property, and rewriting business laws. If Tsvangirai does become president, he says he'll boost production in agriculture and manufacturing. He'll also rebuild roads and telecommunications.
That requires, in the medium term, investment. Investment locally, investment internationally.
That investment has dried up in recent years, as Mugabe's government has driven the economy into the ground. African critics say Tsvangirai's ambitions depend on a vast influx of foreign aid that may come with strings attached. But on the sidelines, there's a potential outpouring of foreign aid should Mugabe step down. The United States imposed targeted sanctions on Zimbabwe in 2001. These will remain until a civilian government is freely elected and the rule of law is restored. In Johannesburg, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Tired of hearing about the housing mess? Well, here's a bright spot. If you were priced out of the boom market, it's possible you might find a home within reach these days. That's one reason mortgage applications are up. A Reuters Zogby poll out this week said a majority of Americans think now is a good time to buy a home. But so much for that bright spot. Many who take the plunge are finding themselves up against a new roadblock. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
On a recent evening in Chicago, Rachel Unruh and Doug Schenkelberg went through the bedtime ritual with their five-year-old Sam.
All right, buddy, it's time to get in bed.
But what about dessert?
Oh.
By now, they thought they'd be eating dessert, not in this rented apartment, but in their own home. A few months ago, they found the perfect place in a suburb of Chicago. Four bedrooms, a deck for grilling. They were ideal buyers. Together, they make more than $125,000 a year. Their credit score is an enviable 800. 850 is the highest. They could afford a 5% down payment. But Schenkelberg says just when it came time to finalize the mortgage.
We got a call from our mortgage broker that said that he had some bad news.
The bad news was that Fannie Mae, the company underwriting their loan, had determined that the house was in a declining market. Fannie Mae expected home prices in the neighborhood to keep falling.
And because it was a declining market, we had to put an additional 5% down in order to purchase the home.
Unruh says that extra 5% added up to another $17,000.
We sort of talked and thought about how we could pull it together. The issue was that, you know, if we went ahead and put down 10%, it kind of eliminated the cushion that we feel comfortable having.
Unruh and Schenkelberg had encountered the downside of falling prices. When prices drop, borrowers with little equity in their home run the risk of owing more on the mortgage than their house is worth. Paul Jackson publishes the mortgage industry news site HousingWire.com. He says to protect themselves, the government-sponsored mortgage finance companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, are requiring a larger contribution from borrowers. Private lenders are doing the same. Jackson says when buyers have more skin in the game, in the form of bigger down payments, they're less likely to walk away.
What lenders are doing now is saying, look, we are getting back 40 cents on the dollar on these loans. We need to make sure that we, going forward, can protect ourselves and make sure that we're not put in this situation again. They're, in my opinion, taking prudent risk management approach to their business.
Fannie Mae's policy does give lenders some leeway. They don't have to charge the extra 5% if they believe a home won't decline in value and can back it up. But fair housing advocates worry these new policies could have unintended consequences. Fannie Mae is classifying declining markets by zip code. Alan Fishbein is director of housing and credit policy at the Consumer Federation of America. Fishbein says by discouraging investment in these areas, the policies could cause even more price declines.
As a practical matter, targeting particular neighborhoods or groups of neighborhoods could have the effect of almost redlining those communities, sending a signal that those neighborhoods were not viable for private mortgage capital.
Redlining refers to a practice common in the 1960s and 70s. Lenders would essentially draw a red line on a map around neighborhoods where they wouldn't invest. These were often older urban neighborhoods, predominantly African American or Latino. Places like Oak Park outside Chicago, where Rachel Unruh and Doug Schenkelberg have been trying to buy. Unruh says the deal they've been trying to make is with a homeowner who could face foreclosure if she doesn't sell.
And, you know, good, stable borrowers like us and other people out there could come in and stabilize that housing market. And it just seems like the system's not working in a way that will let that happen.
Fannie Mae has been meeting with community groups about their concerns. A Fannie Mae spokesman told Marketplace the company is considering making changes to its policy to address those concerns.
How about toothbrush?
It's toothbrushing time at the Unruh Schenkelberg household. Despite Fannie Mae's policy, they may soon get their wish for a new home. They eventually found a community lender who didn't require that extra 5% down. Now they're negotiating with the seller's bank. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
How has the credit crunch affected you? We would like to know. Go to marketplace.org and click on the credit crunch link. Time to check the week on Wall Street with our friend, stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson in Dallas. David, how's it going?
Yeah, friend. Now I'm your friend.
Now you are my friend.
2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, you wouldn't return my calls because it was a bear market.
Oh, and now 3 weeks later, it's a bull market.
Well, I don't know. It looks a lot better. You know, this thing's up. If you just look at the Dow, and you shouldn't just look at the Dow because it's only 30 stocks, but just for fun, this thing was 1,000 points lower a month ago. This is remarkable. I still think
it was 500 points lower a week ago.
Yeah, I know. This is
now. Let me interrupt you and ask you this question: how is this possible when we had banks all over the place reporting massive losses this week? On Wednesday, J.P. Morgan comes out and says, "Yeah, 50% drop in profits," and people like you go, "Woohoo!" and send the market up.
Well, I mean, it wasn't.
What are you thinking, my man?
I'm thinking, you know, it's supply and demand, and there's all this cash sitting over here that's got to go someplace.
Jeez.
I don't know. I mean, I still think there's an economic slowdown. I still think March was just a horrible month. But again, the market is supposed to be looking ahead and several months ahead and a turn. And as bad as the banks were, and I know they bought the banks, I really can't explain that away. You know, the numbers today were terrible. J.P. Morgan's numbers were nothing to write home about. But they're a little optimistic, so I'll buy that. But just forget that for the time being.
Let's forget the banking system.
Since you're going to be that way. if a year ago I had told you that a big, massive investment bank like Bear Stearns was virtually going to vaporize and that a month later the Dow would be up 1,000 points, I mean, you wouldn't believe me. Nobody would believe.
Well, so here we are. It is a month since the Fed came to the rescue of Bear Stearns, and it got a lot of flack for that.
Yeah, it did at the time, but I think at the time some of us were on the record as saying they probably did the right thing, and it was probably a defining moment, and they stepped in and did it. And what it did is it paved the way for Wednesday. You're talking about J.P. Morgan, and the losses were announced on Wednesday, but let me point out to you, IBM came out with earnings were much better than expected on Wednesday, and they said, quote, "We feel good about the rest of the year." And then there was Intel that had earnings that were a penny better than expected, and Wells Fargo's were good, and Coca-Cola beat by a nickel, and CSX, the big railroad, beat by 6 cents.
And we haven't even mentioned Google.
Google, what was Google up today? $89.87. Boy, somebody guessed wrong on that one. So you know the only bad thing that happened this week?
What?
Two airlines decided to merge. Now, this is proof positive, I would suggest to you, that it's going to be an early winter, because when this happens, the nuts are beginning to fall from the trees.
All right. Well, thanks for helping us pick them up.
Have a good weekend.
David Johnson in Dallas. Coming up, the Passover effect on pizza parlors in Israel.
We triple our business in Passover, and there's a huge demand from the secular community. It's definitely the best week of the year, business-wise.
But first, let's do the numbers. Investors rallied behind reports from Google and Citigroup for a stellar day on Wall Street. The Dow surged 1.8%, 228 points to close at 12,849. The Nasdaq soared 2.6%, or 61 points to close at 2402. The S&P 500 moved up 1.5%, 21 points to end the day at 1386. For the week, the Dow and the S&P 500 each cranked up 4.3%. The Nasdaq swelled almost 5%. Google picked up where it left off after the bell yesterday. The internet juggernaut rocketed 20% on the heels of its strong first quarter posting. Bonds traded basically flat today. The yield on the 10-year T-note finished at 3.71. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management, online at shrm.org. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
on the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. President Bush meets with the President of Mexico and the Prime Minister of Canada in New Orleans. This is his fourth and final North American Leaders Summit. Stephen Hawking discusses why we should go into space as part of NASA's 50th anniversary lecture series. And punk rocker Iggy Pop turns 61. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. That famous baseball philosopher Yogi Berra once said, "Nobody goes to that restaurant anymore. It's too crowded." Interesting theory, right? And it applies to baseball itself these days, as teams usurp what was once an innovative strategy for their own gain. Commentator Dan Dresner explains how the Oakland Athletics are coping.
As baseball season begins, few experts are giving the Oakland Athletics a chance to win much of anything. This is not surprising. During the offseason, A's general manager Billy Beane traded away his best starting pitcher and best everyday player for younger prospects in an effort to rebuild after a disappointing 2007 season. Some baseball traditionalists are delighted by the A's woes. To them, this represents a clear rebuke to Michael Lewis's 2003 book, Moneyball. That book chronicled how Billy Beane allegedly outdrafted, outtraded, and outthought other baseball GMs by relying on sophisticated baseball statistics known as sabermetrics. This innovative strategy helped the A's outperform their payroll because Beane signed and drafted players that performed better than baseball scouts expected. He applied a simple economic principle to the practice of building a baseball team. When a business sector is run by an insular old boy network, an outsider can exploit market inefficiencies and reap significant arbitrage opportunities. For some of those traditionalists, the apparent decline and fall of the A's symbolizes the failures of the Moneyball philosophy. But as sabermetric methods have become more accepted in the boardrooms of baseball, Beane and other innovators have fewer inefficiencies to exploit. Since the publication of Moneyball, almost every team in the major leagues has incorporated sabermetric thinking into their organization. The Boston Red Sox won two World Series in the past 4 years while employing Bill James, the godfather of the sabermetrics community. Other franchises around the league have also hired young sabermetrics devotees to help run their front offices. The result? The popularization of sabermetrics has left Beane with less of an advantage. It's harder to find diamonds in the rough when everyone else is mining the same territory. The A's are not struggling because of Moneyball's failure. They're struggling because of its success. This doesn't mean there are no remaining arbitrage opportunities. Beane got more and better prospects in his recent trades than other teams received in return for trading better players. This was because Beane's players were signed to inexpensive multi-year contracts. Just because other GMs are mimicking Beane's past innovations doesn't mean he's run out of new ideas.
Dan Dresner is a professor of international politics at Tufts University. His most recent book is called All Politics is Global. Your comments? Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. Passover begins Saturday evening. For the week-long holiday, devout Jews do not eat bread. Instead, they eat matzah, an unleavened cracker made of wheat and water. It symbolizes the Jews' sudden exodus from Egypt when they were unable to allow bread to rise. In Israel, there are traditional restrictions on the availability of bread during Passover. But this year, both the pious and the secular have reason to celebrate. Daniel Estrin explains.
Roy Wolf manages Aviv, the leading matzah factory in Israel. By the time Passover starts on Saturday, the factory will have made 100 million matzahs. In Israel, it's a $35 million industry.
We are baking 24 hours a day, 6 days a week, from November till April, just before Passover Eve.
That's 6 months of round-the-clock production for just 1 week of consumption. It's the only way to meet the demand. About 70% of Israeli Jews won't be eating bread next week. The rest,
I prefer to eat my loaf of bread in Passover. To stick to matzahs for 1 week, it's a bit too long.
I like bread mostly in Passover. It tastes better because it's not allowed.
For years, selling baked products, from croissants to kreplach, was considered illegal during Passover. The law was never enforced until last year, when a few Jerusalem restaurants were slapped with fines. But a judge recently ruled that restaurants and grocery stores are not public venues. So from now on, as long as they don't display it in the windows or advertise their bread, owners can sell all the bread they want. A kind of don't-ask-don't-tell approach.
I'm going to put, like, cloth that high that block the view. If you walk here, you can see the bread.
Tuli Yadid owns the Riff Raff restaurant. So you're going to put basically, like, a wall of cloth just
to... Something like a wall, yeah. Just, we don't want to make anyone angry. We just want to keep on doing what we're doing, as quiet as we can.
I think it's a sad thing.
Donna Geller is a recent immigrant from the U.S. She loves pizza, but...
It's bread, you know? And I think that that is the least we can do as Jews, no matter what our level of observation is to eat matzah and stay home.
Passover used to be a dead period for pizzerias. Allison Lahav plans to keep her chili pizzeria open next week for the pizza-deprived.
We know it's painful for the religious, and we're not looking to hurt anyone or even to start any fights. We just want to go about our daily lives and do business as secular Jews in Jerusalem. And we triple our business in Passover, and there's a huge demand from the secular community. It's definitely the best week of the year, business-wise.
Not everyone is taking such a relaxed attitude towards this development. A religious political party threatened to quit the governing coalition if the court's decision isn't canceled by Passover Eve. And ultra-Orthodox Jews are planning major protests outside of restaurants that sell bread products next week, which could scare away business. But Allison at the pizza shop is hoping for compromise. Though, when it comes to her own product... Did you ever consider making pizza on matzah?
No, that sounds horrible. Some things, you know, you just shouldn't touch.
In Jerusalem, I'm Daniel Estrin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, we've been talking a lot this week about the worldwide food shortage. Commodities like wheat, corn, and rice are demanding record prices that many countries simply can't pay. But here's an unexpected piece of the puzzle. In a remote part of India, an army of rats has decimated 70% of the rice crop. The region is asking the Indian government for $154 million in aid. This is a phenomenon that happens every 50 years or so because of a bamboo plant that has a rare growth spurt. The rats eat the flowers, get fat and happy, multiply beyond all reason, and then go after the rice. Apparently, they haven't gotten the message about a tasty dish called ratatouille. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow picked up 228 points, 1.8%. The Nasdaq rose 61 points, 2.6%. The S&P added 21 points, 1.5%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Next time on the program, an economist's simple approach to poverty and climate change.
Let's look at the problem systematically, scientifically, understand that the costs of solutions are much less than people fear, and then work together to implement.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Have a terrific weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.